Welcome to The Line, the sports podcast from PR Week.
Hello and welcome to The Line, the sports podcast from PR Week. I'm Richard Gillis and I'm here with Danny Rogers, editor-in-chief of PR Week. And we're going to start by talking about how football transfers became a marketing story. Let's talk for a minute about the podcast before we get going. We've got a group of guests that we will introduce in a moment, but why are we doing this? I remember a lunch. I remember it because I paid for it, as I remember. But the idea we've batted around for a while, but let's get into why we're doing it.
Well, first of all, I'm doing it because I love sport. I mean, I love playing sport, I love watching sport, and I love talking about sport. But professionally, sport has become such a big part of the job that I do, which is writing about marketing and communications. And it seems to me that the sports stories, where once they were back page issues, now the content of sport, the stories around sport, are now front page issues. And, you know, it's such a big industry with so many fascinating people, like some of the guys we've got here today. Such big characters and such big content.
OK, so let's get going. So to help us do that, we've got three people who know this world intimately. Amanda Doherty of Dial Square, and formerly of Arsenal and the FA. Next to Amanda sits Jim Dowling, Managing Director of Cake, the Havas Sport and Entertainment Agency. But first, I'm turning to Tariq Panjar of the New York Times and author of Football's Secret Trade. So I want, Tariq, before we get going, I want you to sort of frame this subject for us. Let's talk about your book for a minute. I was just looking through some of the quotes. Got some lovely quotes on the book cover. Nothing like it in any other sport or industry, although there are similarities with the trade in thoroughbred horses that exchange hands for millions of pounds at auction houses. Jonathan Wilson says, hugely important book. Tariq Panjar is a top-ranked journalist, says David Conn of The Guardian. And Frank, 46, from Prestatin on Amazon, said, better than I thought it was going to be. Gave it 4 stars. Oh. So, what up?
Thanks, Frank. Cost quite a lot of money to get all that.
I know.
Especially David Conn.
Martin Ziegler there, also a bit of money exchanged hands there. So, what's happening? Take us into this world of transfers. Why are we talking about it?
Well, we're talking about it because, first of all, we're all obsessed with football. It is the global sport, and it is now a 365 days a year sport. The likes of cricket and other sports have all year round. They've had to play second fiddle, really. So the transfer market has become a season in itself, and perhaps gets as much attention, as many column inches as the game. We've just had a season start 3 weeks ago, yet I would say the first 3 weeks of the season have still been dominated by the transfer market. There's an element of fantasy to it as well, as for the clubs to sell a dream to the players and the fans, and the fans to kind of think, yeah, you know, we're going to get one more centre forward, we'll get this left back in, and we might win the league. There's all of that, and of course, the players are what drive the interest. Their stories. Manchester United, for example. You've got these massive personalities there. How much are they going to spend? Are we going to get Lukaku? Are we going to go for Morata? It was. These are the last pieces of the jigsaw, and you know, it feeds into the TV story, right? Essentially, all the money that we've seen being spent. You mentioned a number there, 1.4 billion. Did you say for the?
I think that's quoted in the New York Times. It's right. 1.56 billion.
Right, that's for the Premier League. Now, that sounds like it is an extremely, extremely large number. But when we think about the £8.3 billion pounds the 20 Premier League teams are going to get over the next three seasons, it's got to go somewhere. Yeah. The agents know that, the players know that, and the clubs are vying for the best talent. And that's why the numbers are so big. Neymar is a different proposition, of course, because Paris Saint-Germain is effectively owned by a country that has more money than any other country. And spending on sport is a big focus for it. Of course, it happens at a time when Qatar is facing a massive political crisis. Its neighbours have turned against it: Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, UAE. and it needs to show, look, guys, we're still here. Sport puts them on the map, put them on the map, and certainly got them all the column inches over the last few weeks.
Okay, fantastic. Now, we're going to talk about the sort of meaning, and we'll come back to Neymar, and we'll talk about the branding sort of issues and how, and social media, etc. Amanda, I just want to talk to you first of all. I want to go back before we go forward. So when I was preparing for this podcast, myself and Danny asked a load of football hacks who was the best person to talk about football PR and comms from club through to international level, and they all said you. So we asked you, and remarkably you said yes, and you're here you are. 96, you're sort of, I looked on you, looked you up on LinkedIn, and on 96 is when you started at Arsenal. What was it like back then? Take us back to that period.
Well, I started as the media officer at Arsenal. I was the number two to Claire Tomlinson, who's now at Sky Sports News. And we set up the press office at Arsenal. So our first dealing with transfers was the following summer, the summer of 97. So I was taking a look back at what we did at the time, and it was very much bread and butter PR, because it was a news release, a press conference, a photo call, the obligatory scarf held in the air and the shirt in the stadium. And it was with Marc Overmars and the powder blue suit of Emmanuel Petit. And at the time, we were just about to launch Arsenal.com. So we weren't even internet ready at the time. And in terms of engagement between fans and players outside of match day, it was bin liners full of letters that were written to each individual player. In terms of the signings themselves, the idea around the news coverage to be garnered at the time was just a positive for the club. It was a statement of intent for the next season about challenging for the Premier League. It was about providing positivity for the fan base. But also what's really important around signing new players is what happens internally. Because players who are already at the club, they want to know who's coming in. They want to know if they're going to be stood side by side for somebody who can help them challenge for the league. But also, there are those players who their positions are then under threat, so they become more competitive and it drives them to do better as well. And equally, the staff at the club, there was always a buzz around the club when somebody new came in. So that's one part of it. And also, the dynamics around the commerciality of football are very different to what Tarek's just spoken about now. There was money in football in terms of broadcast, but it was probably around £500 million at the time. So actually, from a revenue perspective, other strands were looked at very closely. And I don't know if anyone remembers, but one part of player signing was club call. And if no one remembers club call, it was on the teletext pages and people paid 60 pence a minute to hear the latest. And there was a flash headline on there of Arsenal set to sign striker ? And people would call up. So when you would have the signing, the first interview would be with club call, so the club could extract a revenue
before
from that.
Before you went to the newspapers? Or before
there would be the main press conference, but it would be straight after that. So it would go out. It would go out before the newspapers dropped the next day. So it'd be done at the same time. But of course, now we're talking everything being instantaneous. And as soon as something's announced, it's tweeted. Whereas back then, there was actually a deadline on all these things, an embargo on all these things. And equally at a similar time, the Arsenal magazine brought in a lot of money. So the first big sit-down in-depth interview with a new signing was with the monthly magazine. So very different in 97 to what it is today. And I think over the years, it's changed slightly. But the dynamics of a signing up until probably last year, you would say, with Pogba, have been very similar, because you tend to get more mileage out of players once they've started playing for you.
Yeah.
So you still had owned media and earned media to communicate your
Absolutely.
New signing. It's just that the owned media were very, very different in those days, possibly the earned media too.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, the sort of old standards are still there, aren't they? In some cases, you still see the shirts being held up. One of my favourite bits of a Real Madrid transfer is the physio, sponsored physio, where they all put their thumbs up, and it's, and there's sort of just very, very basic branding stuff going on. So you mentioned Pogba. We're going to come back to Pogba because obviously that was a big moment and I think it is worth dwelling on. I'll introduce Jim Dowling. So Jim's Managing Director of Havas Sport and Entertainment Agency, Cake. Jim, as a QPR fan, this is sort of probably, I'm guessing it's of passing interest to you, all this. I don't know if you knew the window was happening.
No, I have to say we had a very encouraging window because we've signed somebody from Exeter City, and as a QPR fan, I feel much more comfortable that rather than where we were 3 or 4 years ago, bringing in people from God knows where on God knows what. So
I was trying to remember who the record QPR sort of signing was.
That's a very good question.
Christopher Sambo,
I think, would be pretty high up on the list. This guy that came in mysteriously from somewhere, briefly under Harry, and then Harry Redknapp. Lots of people involved, and Christopher came, and then Christopher went, and QPR went down. Fantastic. So happy days, Richard. Thank you.
you're sort of well and truly in the sports business these days, but you started out in PR. Mm. Any football stories you want to tell? Any memories of Arsenal's sort of
initial
website?
There's two things. Starting in Amanda, because one of the first PR jobs I ever did working at my first agency was launching the Arsenal website. And I had the pleasure of introducing Arsene Wenger to the concept of the internet, and secondly, the concept of Arsenal.com, and the fact that fans could not necessarily send letters in by the bin bag, but could directly communicate with the club. And of course, this is one era ending and another one starting. The old era being George Graham and Tony Adams and the slightly different culture that existed at the club, let's say, as opposed to what came in with Wenger. And I remember showing Mr. Wenger a chat forum where they had some rather virulent opinions on some of the signings coming in, at which point Wenger stopped and went, you know, in the very gnomic way that you imagine he would, but just sat back and went, too much information can destroy the fascination. And literally the room went silent. That's the most profound thing I've heard a football manager say ever.
But not only did he bring pasta and training regimes, he was ahead of the game as
that
well.
That was also followed by a very casual shot next to an old-style computer, wasn't it?
Exactly. It's a move on from the scarf. But yeah, it was good days.
The Line is sponsored by Cake, the Havas Sport and Entertainment Agency.
I'm just wondering about, let's go back to Neymar and Pogba, these big name transfers. What's the value, Tariq, to a club? Why are they doing it? At its root?
Pogba first. Well, I think I read recently that for Adidas, he sort of, his performance on the field, I don't think I'm going to be that controversial in saying this. Last year, I don't think he performed in the way we would have expected of the world's most expensive player to perform. He was in Manchester United's midfield. They had he played okay. That might be a function of the Mourinho team. It was an interview today, and it was quite a practical, prosaic way of playing to win football matches. And they finished sixth in the league, won a cup. And then then away off the field, the Pogba brand and the way Pogba sort of carries himself is, did resonate with a lot of people, especially young people. His sort of goal celebrations, the dab, is it the dance move, etc. I mean, the fact I know this is it shows it has resonated a little bit.
I'm nodding sagely.
and he shifted quite a lot of gear for Adidas, and it wasn't sports gear per se. Yeah. It was Pogba wearing what Pogba likes to wear. And it shifted a lot of units. Now, obviously, Manchester United are sponsored by Adidas, and there's a synergy there. But what we got to see here is these players, very very few players, but the very top, they are as relevant or as large as some of the teams they're playing in. They're massive brands in themselves, and their personality often supersedes the game they're playing, I think.
And therefore, you get this huge schism between the club and the player, when the player might be shifting a lot of Adidas and they may be engaging with millions of people on social media, but they're not performing for the club that is paying their salary. That's got to be a problem for the clubs.
I actually think the price tag is not down to the player, it's down to the market. So I always feel a bit uncomfortable when you read the headlines of, you know, X million pound player flop, because it's not their fault. Mm. And Pogba's an exceptional player, and first and foremost, Manchester United and any big club in the country would purchase the player because of what they can do on the pitch, because everything to do with branding. You're right about individuals, absolutely. He's so charismatic. He fits in with all the things that they're trying to achieve. It goes beyond sport into lifestyle. But ultimately, a player becomes that big because of how good they are on the pitch and the success that they bring with the football team that they're playing in. So I think there's a differential in that. The other part of it I was thinking of it the other way around, in that if you take a player like Paul Scholes, who is recognised by many as a player of a generation, and he was signed for Man United, even if Adidas was his, you know, his sponsor, I couldn't imagine him as a personality standing there dancing with Stormzy. Mm-mm. So I think it was just one of those moments in time that everything became aligned for Manchester United, Adidas, and the player. It ticked all the boxes, and I'm not too sure how often it comes around where it's so seamless. They will have worked so hard to achieve that. The campaign was really smooth. It was very well executed, but I'm not sure how people are going to be able to replicate it so well.
I was going to ask, you know, what is it like to be a communications director for a football club now, or a marketing director of a football club at this time? Do you have any control anymore over these things?
I think the difference now is, you know, I haven't been at Arsenal for several years, but what you would have for many years is there was still a mystery and a secrecy around who you were signing. So that first announcement was still a big announcement, whereas now you have a build-up over a long period of time. So transfers always took quite a long time to get done, but people didn't know about them. And now with so many people involved in a transfer, whether it's medical or analytics or agents or managers or chief executives of football clubs, agents, players themselves, there is just such a wide group of people that are involved that it's never quiet anymore. And also because of technology, connectivity is so much easier, so people know something about somebody somewhere. So I don't think you can control the announcement in the way that you used to be able to do. So I think where clubs have been quite smart is they know somebody's coming in, so they will start to tease, and they will start to offer a build-up to when eventually a player signs. They have this piece of content that works for them. And I think what's very smart now, and again going back to Pogba, it actually moved away from being a UK-focused announcement to a global one, and United were just about to go on tour to the Far East, so the timing of the announcement worked just as when they were going to play in, I think, was it China? So I think in that sense, people think about it slightly different. And it's the same with, okay, he's not a player, but Pep Guardiola came in last summer. Manchester City were really smart about his signing. Not only did they bring him in and do a big fan event outside the stadium, but it was the same time they rebranded the crest. So they used that as a platform for them to talk about something that was important to the strategy of the club.
So the marketing, the communications has to be very fluid, very flexible. You've got to be much more opportunistic to make sure that everything, all parts of the orchestra work together when you know something's going to happen.
I think you have both. One part is about working the opportunity, but the other is the planning and what you want to achieve as a club. A lot of clubs now, which they wouldn't have necessarily known or put on paper back then, have got a strategy for the club. You know, somebody like Manchester United, Manchester City, Arsenal, they have a strategy, they have certain values, there are things that they want to be able to achieve. So they are able to plan in advance. I think certainly, I know Manchester United do it, Arsenal definitely do it, in that you gather content in advance and then you slice and dice it and use it at the right time. So whether you are using it to promote a player signing, or if it's around, now there's a balance because of all the money in the game. People think that clubs and players don't give enough back. Actually, the clubs in the Premier League have done an extraordinary amount for community programs and initiatives, whether it's charity, social inclusion, education, for many, many years. But it's not the tasty stuff that people want to read about.
I think that the points you raised there about Guardiola and City and brand values and strategy and all the rest of it, I think brings the sort of the uncomfortable stuff that people don't like seeing or talking about. Because people like to think of football clubs as football organisations, and CEOs and chairmen only care about what goes on the pitch and winning trophies. But everything you've talked about, to me, makes them sound like you're talking about a brand or a big entertainment company thinking about serving customers and a worldwide market. So Real Madrid will frequently quote that they've got, you know, 500 million fans worldwide. You can also call that a global customer base. And a player or a crest is an asset, which they can bring extra revenue streams in. And I think that's the bit where you sort of go, then you start to see, okay, Pogba is the perfect storm. But if you're faced with one midfielder who can bring you 10 assists and another midfielder who can bring you 10 assists, but the other one can perhaps do a little bit more in the marketing field, then I wonder who's going to get the nod.
I don't think that's anything new, though. It's just the way we talk about football, because if you go back through any football club's history, there's been an evolution of a crest. It just wasn't called branding. You know, if you think about how football clubs run, many clubs, Arsenal's obviously changed ownership over the last 6-7 years, but the principles, the values are still the same as what they were, you know, many decades ago. And there are certain things, all you're doing is you're picking them out, yeah, and trying to amplify them and trying to use them to the best of your ability to gather more fans, yeah, to be part of your family.
On the crest, I guess probably right, but in terms of what you're saying, the global fan base, and that's the tension, isn't it, between those fans who we used to come in the rain, we used to queue up when we were crap, and now look, you've charged us up the nose, yeah, and now you're just, yeah, going to China and all of this stuff. And I think there is that tension there. And if you do meet a diehard fan of any team, and they do exist in China or India and Ghana and Nigeria, they will tell you the lineup from a 1975 Cup final, mm-hmm, as much as the guy, yeah, who's there. Mm-hmm. So they feel they've got the ownership to it. And it's kind of the best example I've seen of a crest change for the global audience was West Ham recently, wasn't it? They've got London. They added London to their brand, yeah, because West Ham is, you know, West Ham is, you know, part of East End of London, etc.
Now in the London Stadium.
They're in the London Stadium.
But also, cities are very important. They're an underrated part of this, aren't they? City, you know, if you're looking at it from a global sense, the big major cities are where cultural relevance, yeah, takes place. That's where you can get youth.
I think because you see the brands doing that as well. Adidas, again, an example, and other brands like that, always fixated not on countries and markets, but actually how can we be strong in London and Paris and New York and Hong Kong, the rest of it.
A very good example of that, which would be Emirates Airline, right?
Yeah.
Look, if you look at the teams that company sponsors, it flies into major hubs, and it sponsors football teams in those hubs. You've got Arsenal in London, Paris, Milan. Yeah. It is part of their global strategy, is a city strategy.
Yeah.
And also with players, I guess,
yeah,
you know, we've it's really hard. I mean, Sunderland, I think.
It's always Sunderland. I think
we've heard Sunderland or Stoke. Yeah. Whoever it is you want to kick.
We've heard them talk about it as well, haven't we? You know, yeah, I think they've talked about it. You know, there's two stories. They've got to convince, you know, players to move to parts of the country that are not maybe as cosmopolitan as others.
Yeah. Sunderland.
By offering them more money to go there to play in certain areas. And also there was an interesting story, whether this will happen or not, and you know, I don't know, maybe a traditionalist, makes me a little bit uncomfortable, is where your training ground is going to be. So there is a school of thought that says, look, we play once at most twice a week in the stadium, cup game or a league game, wherever we are. Why don't we have a training ground in London or in Manchester or wherever, where they feel comfortable, where we're more likely to get them to sign, and then they'll go up there for the game, because you know that you can convince someone. And the model for this is a team in Chechnya, I think, which spent a lot of money buying world-class players, but said to them, look, you're going to be living in Moscow.
Yeah.
we'll fly you to...
But that's an interesting... You know, it's a really... That community link, I mean, that breaks that community
Sad,
link.
Sad, yeah, in some way.
Completely, doesn't it? And you made an interesting point about fans overseas, and they can't, you know, they are genuine fans. Because quite often, when you listen to people in sports marketing, they quite often are quite dismissive of the social media numbers. And you obviously, they are flaky in terms of, you know, they're, some of them are just clicks on a Facebook or... But you are the variation of what a fan is changes. But it's also, it is important to remember that they are genuine fans in some cases.
Because a lot of cases.
You listen to the worry. I mean, it used to be that clubs weren't allowed to call themselves brands, and I remember that was a, you know, and it's still the case, and fans hate that. There's now a tendency to look at football clubs as sort of harvesting data. If you listen to the sort of data industry, and they want clubs to be almost like versions of Amazon, where you're transacting. It's a reason to buy stuff.
Mm.
You know, it's a salient, or just a relationship which is there to be exploited and commercially exploited. So it's quite a tricky, it's a difficult one.
A lot of marketers are selling that right now. And, you know, football for... I covered FIFA quite a bit, and you know they always have their annual reports saying, you know, it's been away from some of the stuff we've read about with the various lawsuits and criminal cases, etc. But selling the World Cup, there's always been this kind of upward trajectory, and there've been a lot of backslapping among themselves. Look, we've got revenue going up, etc. But effectively, essentially, football should be, it's the world's game, and people, you know, as much as you want to need a glass of water, a lot of people need their fix of football, and it's quite an easy sell. Now, if this sport is such an intrinsic part of individuals' lives, and that connection is being used then to start selling them all this stuff that they may or may not want, that might make a few people feel a little bit uncomfortable, I guess, that much data collection of someone who can't live without it, I guess, right?
Jim was saying earlier that the average viewer of a football match on television, right, mm-hmm. was somebody in their early 40s.
Yep.
If you're going to attract younger people to engage with the actual sport itself,
yep.
you know, is all this stuff damaging that?
Well, yes, arguably, but I don't think the younger audience notices that yet. I always look at... they're just getting into football in a different way, the old-fashioned way of the 40-year-old getting his son. My 40-year-old dad, if he liked football that much, would have got me into football going, come on, son, we're off down to Loftus Road this weekend. That doesn't work in the same way anymore. I go take my son to play football on Saturday mornings, and I see all the kids turning up in their football shirts, and there's a Barcelona, there's a Real Madrid, there's a Borussia Dortmund shirt, and then might be a smattering of Chelsea and whatever, but that's it. And it's and those kids are getting into football through FIFA, through Champions League, interestingly. That's the dream, is to win the Champions League, not the cup final when I was a kid, you know. So they're just going into it in a different way.
There's the weird kid in a QPR shirt, isn't there?
Yes, unfortunately.
Hovering
yeah.
in the corner.
Yeah. One.
He's doing yeah. okay, though.
He's a
fine.
Sort of
Thanks
eccentric. He's an eccentric
he is, yeah.
Jacob Rees-Mogg character. Just an, yeah, it's an yeah. affectation. He's wearing a monocle and a QPR shirt.
Yeah. But what it is doing is, I guess there is a loosening of the local community, as in, I must support my local team. Kids are still loving and enjoying football, but getting into it in a different way.
I think clubs and also the Premier League are encouraging people to get involved in football in a different way as well. The Premier League are working really hard on changing the perception just around the amount of money going into the game. They've set up primary stars. I don't know if you saw the launch a few months back, but it's getting educational programmes into all primary schools in England and Wales over the next few years. So that's working with the clubs as well. And you had players like Juan Mata and Theo Walcott working on that at that campaign. So it's helping with, you know, literature and numeracy, also getting kids, you know, up out of their seats and playing sports. So yes, there is a lot of money within the game, but actually a lot of money is being spent on really good things within this country. And we've not to forget as well the amount of money coming into Premier League clubs through particularly the broadcasting rights goes back into our economy as well. Mm-hmm. It's probably over, is it £2 billion in tax they paid last year?
Yeah.
The other kind of part to all of this, I guess, is
the affordability again. Just we talked about it earlier. Now, I had one thought. You know, a lot of clubs are trying to like the big marketing piece is also the friendly club aspect of it, which they look like quite rapacious, big money clubs. Yeah. Now, if you look at the revenue streams, the three revenue streams, there's only two. Well, Manchester United, say in the Premier League, have got a very easy division in three parts of television, commercial, and stadia. The rest of them, right, take away two or three, again, of the very big ones, would have almost 80% of their revenue is coming from TV.
Yeah.
So I would say, I would argue maybe a club, because the Premier League, one of the things it sells is passion. Full stadiums is one of the things it sells the world.
Yeah.
We've got the most passionate sets of football supporters in the world. Now, if you read some of the articles, I know Amanda's here, ex-Arsenal, there's been a lot of stories about how quiet the Emirates is and some of the other stadiums, not just the Emirates, Old Trafford's pretty quiet sometimes. The ticket prices in the UK are really high. However, if you think that as a revenue stream is diminishing more and more as TV revenue goes higher and higher, and it could go higher again, why not slash your ticket prices as a CSR or even more than that? Great for your
image. I mean, I remember asking that question to the marketing manager or marketing director of Milan, AC Milan, and he literally spat his coffee all over me and laughed in his face. I said, well, why not, you know, why let them in free? You know, TV, your money's coming from media. TV abhors a vacuum, you know, can't bear an empty stadium. And there is a cultural shift there that is going to be really difficult to get beyond. I don't know what you think about that, Amanda, but it's very hard, you know, to go to football clubs and say, okay, let's slash prices. I think prices, this is a bit of a hobby horse of mine, but I don't understand why, if you're a sponsor, you wouldn't be the hero here.
Which is what Virgin did, which with the 20s Plenty. Yeah. And they subsidised that, and the PR they got off the back of it was extraordinary.
Yeah, yeah. There was also the Cup, the predecessor of the Carling Cup sponsor, the bank. Oh, what's their name?
Capital One.
A great branding exercise. Can't remember their name, but they did pay for travel. They started paying for travel. And that was a nice sponsorship activation. They started paying for away travel, etc. But the cost of football and sponsors, you know, quite often are seen as a sort of necessary evil. You know, they just pile the money in for the new left back and we'll put up with the logos. But actually, it's a real opportunity, you would have thought, to help the fans. And I'm surprised that fewer, not more of them do it.
I think over the years, sponsors have done different things with clubs to engage with fans. I mean, I certainly remember a couple of instances where the last season at Highbury, we had the idea, I don't know if you recall, but to turn the stadium red and white for the final game. So we gave everybody T-shirts. O2 basically paid for that, and it was the I Was Here moment. So that was very straightforward brand exercise. But we also did a piece with Citroën. Citroën was the car sponsor for a number of years with Arsenal. And actually one of the things that got them to change their approach around how they worked with Arsenal, we asked them to get involved with our charity partnership with Teenage Cancer Trust. And we asked them for one of their new vehicles so that we could work with Gerald Scarfe, the artist, who did Pink Floyd's Another Brick in the Wall, together with a couple of our players and one of the Teenage Cancer Trust's cancer patients at the time. And they designed this car, which was then raffled. And the mileage that Citroën got out of being involved in that, it took Arsenal outside of the sports pages, but it brought Citroën into them. And if you look back, there's some really good pieces of social media content with Arsenal and Citroën over the years. I think they had players dressed as ballerinas at one point in time. So I do think sponsors are looking at more imaginative ways and creating more compelling content that works not only for their audience, but the wider sporting audience as well.
I think they've been lower expectations of sponsors in football versus other entertainment industries. We worked in sport and live music, and the contrast with putting a logo up at football ground versus a live music venue is ridiculous. I remember putting Carling logos up at the Brixton Academy for the first time, and they tell you they don't want you there, and so it forces sponsors to adjust and go, okay, well, what's our role here? Football is different because fans have got used to saying we need money to pay these expensive wages, so there's less demand for sponsors to do more. But you're absolutely right with Citroën, is that when sponsors go, well, wait a minute, people are in love with this game, and if we can bring more love to this game courtesy of our role, then that's when we start to reap the benefits.
It's around the narrative a lot of the time, I feel. Mm.
Do you think there's lots of sponsors, that's the thing, it's quite a noisy marketplace, isn't it?
Yeah.
I thought something that was quite interesting last week was the hand-wringing about the Carabao Cup draw, which is the League Cup.
Now
I don't know how many, all of us know that if it no one was paying any attention to the League Cup
exactly.
draw, right, in the first round or the second round. It was done at 10:30 or 11 o'clock on a midweek, and no one paid any attention. There was very few people writing about it. Now,
it's a rare day when someone says, you know, I've got to go home for the pub to watch the Carabao Cup draw.
Absolutely. Now you think, they've had two hits at this. It was just like, you know, you got, you know, Henry Winch or someone writing a whole column in the Times about Carabao.
Yeah.
Now, I'd never heard of Carabao.
I certainly have now.
What I'm saying is...
It's the slow cow of the East, isn't it? That's what a Carabao is.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
You see, whether we like it or not, I actually like the fact that people are thinking about doing things differently. It doesn't mean to say that it's right, but I just think the worst situation to be in is to tread water and to stay the same. So at least they're thinking about it differently. Whether or not it's the right conclusion is another matter.
There's also the narrative of the football fan is always they're conservative. They want, you know, the days of yore. They want the old days. And actually, that's not true in many cases. And it'll be interesting the next Premier League round of rights when they start introducing other times, potentially other ways, you know, maybe more Saturday night games potentially, or morning fixtures. So it's just in terms of the response, it's an easy story as a journalist to write that all the fans are against this, they're traditionalists, but actually
and then things change and people go, oh, that's quite a good idea, you know, I think one of the smartest things UEFA did was shift the Champions League final to Saturday night. You can't do that. Champions League is always on the Wednesday.
Well,
we'd quite like some families to watch this game. And lo and behold, it's one of the many things that has lifted that tournament up.
That's the same with the FA Cup final. It's now tea time on a Saturday, which is great for viewing figures. However, if you are a team from the north, it's a real challenge because the train services don't go back up north afterwards.
Yeah.
And so there needs to be more communication around
that
to make it smoother for the people who are actually paying out the money and want to go and see the game live.
Totally.
The Line, where sport meets the marketing business.
We've talked about the sort of big name transfers. I want to talk about one of the most exciting and fastest growing areas of football, which is the women's game. So we've had a summer of you know, front and back pages. We're seeing brands coming into football in a way that into women's football in a way that we haven't in the past. I just want to get your view. Arsenal were very early in the game in terms of the women's game. Where's it going? What's its future? What's the genuine sort of business case for women's football, do you think?
I think Arsenal were ahead of their time, and I think, unfortunately for Arsenal, the challenge was that they were the only team at the time, so they were forever winning everything, sort of games 9-0, which meant it wasn't competitive, which meant people didn't want to go and see it because they knew it was going to be, you know, a one-sided game. They knew what the result was going to be. What I do think's happened, certainly in the last, 6-7 years since the introduction of the Women's Super League, is teams, whilst they're not necessarily professional, they're much more professional. And clubs lose quite a lot of money on the women's game, but Chelsea, Manchester City, Arsenal, they've all invested very heavily into the women's game. So that's brilliant for it. On top of that, what's incredibly important is the Football Association have made it part of their four-year strategy to double the number of women's teams and girls' teams in the country, which means there is investment not only from the big clubs but also from the governing body of football, which can only be great for the women's game. There's lots of really imaginative things going on as well to encourage girls to play football. There are those that, you know, are interested in the role models like Steph Horton or Lucy Bronze, but there are also those who like Little Mix. And I thought what the FA did really well this summer, actually ahead of the Euros, was use the brand ambassadors they had in the players, but they also did a salute which was started by Little Mix. So it went out across social media to try and engage with girls, you know, to get their boots on and get playing. And I think it's a really exciting time, and they're just about to launch, you know, the new version of the Women's Super League, which turns back to a winter season, which I think will help the women's game as well.
Yeah,
I think it's very exciting for a lot of that, the creativity you're seeing in it. I think it's great the women's game is getting support from sponsors and organisations and broadcasters that are now starting to step up to the plate, and you can see that not just in football but cricket this summer. Was fantastic event, but also the audience and the market's clearly there. I saw that the more eyeballs watching the women in the World Cup 2 years ago than were watching the Open Championship on the BBC, which is held up as one of the big staples of the end. And that tournament was played in Canada, wasn't it, with kickoffs at 11 o'clock at night.
Yeah. Well, I'd be interested to know, not to sort of dampen down expectations, but the thing, what with the cricket and the World Cup and these Euros that were held this summer, is that these are national team competitions. And I think people get very passionate about their country. I remember the curling, when the Rona Mitchell they won a winter gold medal, and we were up, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning watching curling, etc. What will be the interesting thing to see moving forwards is not when England are playing, but when Chelsea are playing Brighton in a Women's Super League game. Are those numbers increasing? Are the papers still as excited about telling those stories? But cricket too, or any sport, but if we're talking about football. And also, and are the sponsors as excited to get involved in sort of league play?
That's what I was going to ask, actually, Jim. How many brands are investing tangibly in women's sport at the moment? I don't mean just Kate clients, any brand.
Yeah. More and more. And I think the ones that have invested heavily from the start will reap the biggest benefit. You look at a brand like Kia, who's been supporting English cricket, women in the English cricket game. They will reap the benefits of that long term, because they're genuinely supporting, not just handing over cash, but supporting the team that desperately needs it. You know, there was a lovely story of when Charlotte Edwards, you know, was heard the news that actually the England team were going to get a sponsor 4 or 5 years ago or something. It was like she might get paid £30,000 a year for a salary. You know, she pulled the car over because she was shocked. You know, this is not long ago. As with all these things, you know, brands don't want return on their investment, which isn't just coming from feeling good and supporting people. They want to see audiences, but it works with other people working in concert with one another. Broadcasters giving more airtime to sports so that we can fall in love with those sports is a good thing. Brands will follow.
Any other examples of big brands investing in women's sport?
SSE, what I would throw in.
Right.
FA Cup.
Absolutely.
Sponsorship.
And they don't sponsor anything in the men's game at all, I don't think. So they've kind of got ownership of that. But just on terms of broadcasters, you know, I guess we haven't talked about is how we're all watching sport now. And you know, we have the OTT, for example. Women's sport, women's football, etc. Could you see that being part of a long tail somewhere? I've streamed online and build a decent audience that will then translate into more mainstream TV.
There is an argument to suggest that the traditional broadcast led model wasn't working for women's football, and actually it's closer and you know, trying to just be a version of men's football isn't, well, it wasn't the way forward. And actually what's happening is that there is more of a grassroots, build it up from the grassroots, more akin to things like Park Run and Tough Mudder, where these are sports that are growing outside of broadcast. Broadcast is utterly irrelevant to them, and actually they exist, they're social media led and digitally led. And so women's football, it feels like that might be a model, in which case it, you know, that sponsors, that's what they want. They want access to people. The stars are refreshing at the top end, but as Amanda said, you've got some great activities going on in the grassroots end of things, in the same way we've always seen in the US. You know, so that it's a different model, actually copying the sort of broadcast, that linear broadcast model that has happened in football. A lot of sports have fallen into the trap of trying to copy that by saying, right, okay, we need a TV deal, we need a sponsor who wants eyeballs, and then the rest will fall in line. And actually that's not the case anymore, and doesn't need to be. So there is an argument, I think, to suggest that actually the model, the business model for women's sport might well be different. And there's a tangible shift in brands seeing a business case in women's sport. It used to be it was closer to charity than commercial investment. There was a sort of, okay, well, we will support women's sport with a magnanimous gesture. But now actually what we're seeing is brands coming in and saying, actually, no, there's a business case to be made for this, and that's critical to evolve.
So this summer has seen so many football transfers sort of sealed on social media. You know, what is the mix now for a communications professional in terms of content via social media and the use of traditional media?
I think over the last couple of years, you've seen more clubs not have press conferences with players that have signed and have announced via their own social media platforms and the platforms of players. And that gets out far and wide. It's global. But what's interesting for me is there is absolutely a place for traditional media, and I think there always will be. Even though newspaper sales are declining, the football writers in particular have got a bigger voice as what they've ever had, because they've got their own big social media followings, and also they are on radio stations and on TV as well talking about it. And during this particular time frame, what tends to happen is when nothing is on the record until things have happened, things are happening off the record, and I imagine there's a lot of briefing that's taking place with particularly football writers and maybe Sky Sports news reporters, so they've got a flavour of what's going on. And some of that is about jockeying to get your player to the right club for the right price, or retaining a player. So I do absolutely feel there's a place for traditional media still. Yeah,
Tarek, how does it work from the journalist perspective? I mean, the sort of lead time on a scoop these days, I'm thinking, is absolutely tiny in terms of breaking a story or breaking a transfer story. There's so little in it. There's an enormous amount of work in generating it, but trying to be the person with the news is the value of that is quite small.
Exactly, it depends on is it the journey or the destination, right? I think a lot of the interest is in the journey, and then by the time X signs for your team, you've kind of been teased about it for quite a long time. And there's also I wonder for the newspapers, by the time the person has signed, what they have to say about it is probably not as interesting as the chase, which kind of to me gives a lot of value to particularly the tabloids of teasing the potential readers or the fans with what is possible rather than what is actually going to happen. So you would have seen, I mean, I think one of my colleagues, actually Rory Smith, did a really good story about transfer rumours. The transfer rumours often are what drive the traffic rather than the transfer fact. So he tracked down this guy in Ireland who thought, you know what? I think all of this is nonsense. I don't think these guys actually care what they're whether it's true or not, and they're gonna just publish some of this stuff.
Fake news.
I think almost Football Transfers was ahead of this kind of hashtag fake news period by 20 years, to be honest with you. Mm. And he decided, yeah, I'm just gonna be a guy who creates, I think it was a website, right?
Where he just invented a player, didn't he? And
that's right, he invented a player.
Invented a whole career, and got media to report he'd been bought and sold, and so stuff was printed endlessly.
Before you get on your high horse there, Dean Holdsworth question that we need to address. I don't know if you want to tell that story.
Yes, well, yeah. Oh, God, yeah, this goes back to the disastrous pieces of PR. Actually, at a similar time, launching the Arsenal website. This is how these things began. I was, working in a PR agency, not working alone. There might be others listening to this podcast that will remember this story and played a part in it, where we were representing a brand who was desperately trying... It was opening a new store. The brand in case actually was Timberland, who had opening a new store in Covent Garden. And they're trying to generate some interest about the store's now open. So we had... It's about 97 or something. So we had booked in to represent Timberland Lee Dixon of Arsenal. Might have gone to you for clearance, Amanda, and Dean Holdsworth of Wimbledon. And, you know, hello media, would you like to come to the store? I mean, no, we're not very interested. Right, we need to do something. So we then essentially went into a room and put funny voices on it. Can I speak to the sports desk? I've got some hot transfer news. I'm not talking unless someone pays me. What? Who are you? Well, I want to talk to someone. I can tell you, fact, right, Dean Holdsworth is going to join Arsenal. And I want payment. Put the phone down. And of course, we call up 3 hours later. I go, would you be interested in coming? We've got, you know, and they're like, Dean, is there any truth in your going to Arsenal? We're like, there you go. Picture in the paper, and off you go. It's just
job done.
Fake
job
news
done.
From 20 years ago. I apologise to all those involved, but you know.
You see how PR works?
I apologise, Amanda.
You know, Danny, this is like, you know. It doesn't shock
me.
Nothing shocks Danny. Now, we have come to the end of the first podcast. I want to thank our guests, Jim, Tariq, and Amanda. Thank you, Danny, for your company. The Line is a collaboration between PR Week and Cake. It's produced and edited at the HKX building by Adam Vesey, Deo Adene, and Renato Camillo at Cake, and Matt Whipp at PR Week. Thanks for listening. You can subscribe to The Line via prweek.com, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. Till the next time, thanks for listening.
The Line, where sport meets the marketing business.